Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. As we journey back to the age of towering empires and fallen cities and examine discoveries like the Babylonian Chronicles and the Cyrus Cylinder, we learn more details about the rise and fall of kings named in the Bible. Together, these artifacts reveal a powerful truth. The scriptures are not legends detached from history, but accounts rooted in real events that shaped the ancient world. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this discussion entitled Nebuchadnezzar and the Persian Kings. And you'll also find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into the conclusion of this incredible interview.
With regard to the Persian kings, they figure prominently as well. And these books you want to look at are the post-exilic books of Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah. The Persian kings are mentioned in there. And of course, if we start with Cyrus the Great, he is mentioned, as Pat said, in Isaiah chapter 45. You can look at verses 1 through 7. He is mentioned 100 years before he's ever born, that God was going to use him to conquer Babylon, who was holding his people captive, and release the Jewish people. And then we find the Cyrus Cylinder, as Pat mentioned as well, that is what some call the first charter of human rights. It allowed people to go back home to build their high places, their temples, and so forth. Though the Jews weren't mentioned by name in that cylinder, it was a empire-wide proclamation that was going to let the people go back to Jerusalem, start building the temple, and so forth. And Darius the Great, you can see him in Ezra chapter 6, verses 1 through 13, and it tells of Darius's search of the royal documents there at the palace, and which authorized the Jews to rebuild their temple and their city. And Ezra tells us that Darius not only gave them permission to continue the building in Jerusalem, but that he also gave aid for the restoration project there as well. So it's just amazing. The government-sponsored reconstruction project of Jerusalem was supported by Darius. And then Xerxes the First. Now, he's the king that we see in the book of Esther. And he is the one who chose Esther as the queen of Persia. You can see Esther chapter 2. Xerxes begins to regret his decision to, you know, vanish Queen Vashti, and he decides to find a new person, and he puts out a proclamation empire-wide for attractive young virgins to come and compete for his hand as the queen. And that would be more of a political title. It's an honorary position. And if he didn't make that honorary position, these women would just go into his harem and probably never hear from them again. They weren't allowed to marry after that and so forth. But Xerxes the First is known by his Hebrew name Ahasuerus. That's taken from his old Persian name. So Xerxes is the Greek name. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name taken from the old Persian. So we can't get these confused and think that they're like three different kings. And then you have Artaxerxes to round out the Persian kings, the first. Can't confuse him with Artaxerxes the second, because the second comes about 100 years later after the first. We're talking about Artaxerxes the first. And you can look to Ezra chapter 7. It says, in the seventh year of his reign, he gave a letter to Ezra giving permission to return to Jerusalem with the king's gold, his silver, his provisions to help in the reconstruction. And then later, it says, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign, that Nehemiah would be given permission to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls of the city. So throughout the biblical text, we see a clear picture of these kings mentioned in the Bible, and there is no doubt about the historicity these days. Now it's only a question of filling in little details here and there with regards to each one of these Persian and Babylonian kings' reigns.
Fascinating, and thanks for that. That was a great summary. You know, I'm going to pause on one of the people you mentioned. Obviously, you mentioned Nebuchadnezzar, and he's well attested to in Kings. And then you said Daniel. And there are scholars out there who would claim that, sure, we know a lot about Nebuchadnezzar. We have ample historical evidence for that, but we have very little on the prophet Daniel. And their line of reasoning goes something like this. If Daniel was as important a figure as he was in Nebuchadnezzar's life, why don't we really hear more about him? Why isn't there other historical documents attesting to him? So, Pat, I'll just throw it out to you to start. We do know that Daniel is the Jewish name that we understand him as, but he also went by Balthazar, which means Bel's prince. So maybe help our listeners understand that the main historical figures, these kings, be it Persian kings or Babylonian kings, are prominent, but not always people underneath them are recognized in the archaeological record.
Yes, that is correct. And one of the things that would attest to the historical integrity of Daniel is a lot of what we call these cultural and historical synchronisms, these details about the culture and the history of these kingdoms. The Bible mentions them, historians questioned it, and then through later discovery, we found they were right on target. And when a author or historian gets these kinds of details right and they sync up nicely, you've got an accurate, reliable historical account. You know, a great example is Daniel chapter 5, when Cyrus came in to Babylon. It says Belshazzar was the king of Babylon there when Cyrus came in. It was Belshazzar ruling in the city of Babylon. And historians looked at that and said, ah, you see, we've got an error here. Belshazzar is the son. He's not the king. Nabonidus is the king of Babylon. We've got a mistake here. Ha ha. And then he names Daniel. He says, Daniel, you can interpret this writing on the wall. I'll appoint you to the third highest position here in the land. And archaeologists and historians looked at that and said, that's really strange. Third highest. That's weird. Well, what we discovered the verse account of Nabonidus. And Nabonidus was a general. He was a fighting man. He didn't like to be in the capital city. Maybe it was just too stressful or something. He was often out with his army outside the city of Babylon, and he entrusted it in his writings to guess who? His son Belshazzar, who he appointed as, you know, the co-regent or king of Babylon. And so the record records when Cyrus came in, yeah, Nabonidus wasn't in the city. He was with his army in another location. And so Belshazzar was the ruling king in that city. And he appoints Daniel. He says, I'll make you the third highest in the land. Well, that's historically accurate because number one is Nabonidus. Number two is his son who's ruling as co-regent, Belshazzar. And so Daniel would get the third highest position. And so when you've got historical and cultural synchronisms like that, I mean, the Bible just nailed it. When you see that in books, you know, historical books, you know you've got an accurate, reliable historical record. And that's what you see in Daniel. So when you see that over and over again, that's what we're finding. And that's what archaeology is confirming in the book of Daniel. You can reasonably be sure this was written by a guy who, you know, was living during that time, and Daniel be a great candidate there.
Yeah, great answer. And that word historical synchronisms is an important word for our listeners to remember, because a lot of times the silence of certain figures doesn't mean that the archaeological record is complete. You know, silence in the archaeological record does not make the Bible unreliable. It just means we have yet to discover these, so we look for these historical synchronisms. Joe, before I get to the next question, is there anything you would like to add on that about archaeology hasn't found every person discussed in the Bible, but that doesn't mean that they were not historical figures.
That's so true, because there's more data to be discovered. And secondly,
you have some of these throwaway pieces of archaeology that list some insignificant detail. And if these insignificant details are true, shouldn't we give the benefit of the doubt to the major figures of Scripture? For example, King Jehoiachin's ration record. This is a record written in stone that talks about the rations that were given to King Jehoiachin while he was in exile in Babylon. It was King Jehoiachin and his sons were taken away by Nebuchadnezzar back to Babylon. And you can see 2 Kings 24 and 2 Kings 25 about this. And ultimately, Jehoiachin was given rations of oil and supplies because later Nebuchadnezzar's son, Evil-Merodach, released Jehoiachin from prison along with his sons and ultimately gave them a daily allotment of rations. And so he was being treated more in a kingly state rather than just as a prisoner in lockup. Now, if that fact is true, and it seems to be consistent with everything we know about the biblical revelation of 2 Kings 24 and 25 and Nebuchadnezzar's exploits, then shouldn't we give the benefit of the doubt to Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel's role within that king's empire? There's another little throwaway detail, Sarsakim. The Sarsakim tablet was discovered in the 1800s near Baghdad, and it was only deciphered recently in 2007 by a professor from University of Vienna. His name was Michael Jursa. And it lists this person named Sarsakim who had donated something to a pagan temple back in Babylon. This is a throwaway receipt that has somebody who's mentioned in Jeremiah 39 verses 3 and 4 as one of Nebuchadnezzar's under captains or Rabsaris or one of the leaders in the military under Nebuchadnezzar. And this was the same man who saw Zedekiah, king of Judah, fleeing for his life when Nebuchadnezzar came to attack the city. And if that is found, just this little throwaway receipt with Sarsakim's name on it, the same individual we see mentioned in Jeremiah 39 that saw Zedekiah, then why shouldn't we give the benefit of the doubt to Daniel and to what he did within the kingdom? So there's no reason to doubt these things.
Yeah, so good. Great answers, both of you. And again, silence in the archaeological record does not make the Bible unreliable. It just means we need to do more archaeology. And that's why we have a whole program at Veritas International University where we train archaeologists such as Pat Zuckeron on the broadcast, helping guide us through the archaeological record. We're training archaeologists so they could go out and uncover more to demonstrate that the Bible is indeed a reliable and trustworthy source. So, Pat, let's move to our fourth and final D before we move to maybe some more updated excavations that are happening in Persia and Iraq. But that fourth D is denotation. Kind of wrap all of this up. Why are these archaeological discoveries important, not only to the Bible, but to history? But what do they tell us about Babylon, Persia, and the biblical record?
Yes, well, you know, archaeology confirms the historical reliability of the Bible. The kings of Babylon and Persia are named in Scripture, and they're historically verified by these archaeological discoveries here. But not only just their names, you know, the dates of their reign and their political roles align with the biblical record and the extra-biblical records. They match up very well. And that affirms that the Bible is historically reliable here. And not only their dates and their offices, but also what they did, their actions and their policies correspond well with what the Bible reports. And when you put the Bible and these historical records together, the Bible also gives insights and accounts of these kings and their rules. I mean, we are very fortunate here. It's very rare that you have written accounts that tell you what the archaeological discovery you just made is. And so in the Bible, we have something very unique. And As Joe was mentioning here, and you as well, when you've got these synchronisms that match up, that, it was Belshazzar in the city of Babylon while his father Nabonidus was out of town here, and Daniel was given third highest rank. You got officials like Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus allowing the Jews to return home and rebuild their temple. Cyrus records in his records that he didn't want to offend the gods of the other civilizations. So he was careful about that. And that's why he allowed them to return home and rebuild their sacred buildings. You've got these details that match up consistently here with the biblical records. So these discoveries consistently matching up with the biblical record in names, dates, government structures, historical events, all build a great cumulative case for the historical accuracy of the Bible.
So good. Thanks for that, Pat. Well, Joe, as we've mentioned many times on previous broadcasts, you wrote your book several years ago, and there is continual archaeological excavations and research going on in the areas we've discussed. So the same is true in Persia and Iraq. So maybe help our listeners get some current, more recent information of what is happening there in Iraq and Persia that may have some correlation to the biblical record.
Some of the modern archaeological research being done in Persia and Iraq and so forth, sometimes it's limited due to political considerations, but that doesn't mean the show has stopped. They're continuing. In fact, at Tell Mascouda, they have found a bowl, silver bowls that refer to Geshem the Arabian, who opposed Nehemiah in the book of Nehemiah. You can see Nehemiah 6:6 to read about Geshem. He was one of Nehemiah's adversaries and so forth. But in other discoveries, we have found other silver bowls with the names of Artaxerxes and Xerxes and Darius being inscribed into these silver bowls of Persia dating to the 5th century BC. And these are the same kings being mentioned in Esther and Ezra and Nehemiah. But there's more. Even in Jerusalem, you have these, what you call bulla. These are stamp seals, usually in moist clay. They harden over time, and they have impressions of people's names and positions and titles. And these date to the Persian period as well. And there's all kinds of different things we can learn from these bulla to see how the Persians administrated in the Jerusalem area during the time it was under Persian rule. Even in Iraq, we find what you call alamasu. These are large engraved wall ornamentation, so to speak, carved into the wall of pictures of hybrid animal human beings with wings on them. It's a picture of blessing. They were seen as blessings, good fortune, good luck, riches, and abundance, and so forth. And we find them throughout all the ruins of Iraq and Persia. They're just about everywhere. And they talk about this powerful dynasty of Persian and Babylonian kings. Or you can go to Babylonia, just right there near Baghdad, and you see that the Al-Yehuda tablets have been discovered as well, which literally means Judah town. And it is written in cuneiform language, and it talks about the Jews' day-to-day lives when they were exiles in Babylon. Tax payments, farming, business activities that were taking place ultimately in Babylon. All this continued research is really conducted as a forensic science. It's much like what detectives do after a crime scene. They piece together whatever's remaining or left over and then form a conclusion about what was going on in that certain environment. And they have mastered this forensic science known as archaeology because so much has been found. It really leaves very little speculation on the part of the archaeologist itself. And that gives me great comfort knowing that Christianity is a historic Christian faith. It's rooted in reality. It's grounded in the real world.
And I just want to underscore the importance of continual study in biblical archaeology, because these are finds that are currently happening, or at least within the last few years. So we need more biblical archaeologists out in the field doing the excavation work. Well, Pat, let's conclude with this before we wrap things up. You had mentioned earlier something that may have caught our listeners' attention, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And you'd mentioned that in some ancient Roman texts, they mentioned that, like such as Josephus and Strabo mentioned these ancient hanging gardens. And we know from a variety of sources that these Hanging Gardens of Babylon were considered one of the ancient wonders of the world. So what do you think these gardens look like, and what would it take for archaeologists to discover evidence for them?
Yeah, this is one of the more intriguing mysteries here of history here, because we don't have any hard archaeological artifacts here. We've got written records, as you said, from these Roman historians. And so, you know, what were these gardens like? Well, these were probably a man-made terraced mountain made of stone, as these Roman historians record. No one really knows exactly how, you know, the dimensions of the Hanging Gardens, but many guess they're maybe 1 to 3 acres and about 60 to 100 feet high from the description of these historians. And these would have been ascending terraces, may have looked like a giant stepped pyramid. And each level would have been impressive because they would have been supported by stone columns and vaults. And these balconies, these platforms, had to be wide enough so they're capable of holding soil that's deep enough to plant trees in there. So it would have been pretty impressive to have this green mountain rising in the middle of the flat Mesopotamian plain. If you go out there to the Middle East there in Mesopotamia, it's kind of like Dallas, Texas, you know, it's just kind of flat out there. And in the middle, you would have had this exotic garden with tall trees like cedars and palms and fruit trees and flowering plants and vines and a serious high-level irrigation system, because, you know, in these areas it's very dry. And Strabo says that these gardens were elevated and water had to be lifted up somehow mechanically from the Euphrates. And so there was some kind of advanced irrigation system here, a pump, some kind of mechanism getting water up to these terraces here. What kind of discoveries would confirm this? We'd probably have to find some kind of massive substructure here, some kind of thick stone foundation. A lot of the structures in Babylon mostly use mud brick, but this one says it was made of stone and it would probably need a thick and large stone foundations with huge vaulted rooms or arches, being able to support this kind of soil and water system. You'd probably have to find some kind of irrigation system here, vertical shafts or wells, stone-lined channels, plaster-lined channels and pools for water storage. You'd probably have to find biological, botanical evidence, you know, pollen grains and seeds from plants that were grown there, but also were not native there. And of course, the key would be to find some kind of inscription from Nebuchadnezzar mentioning that here are the hanging gardens that I built here. So those are some of the discoveries. If we could find those, we could confirm that this was not mythological, that perhaps these hanging gardens were indeed a reality here.
Fascinating, and it really is a call. We need more biblical archaeologists. So give us a call at Veritas if you're interested in biblical archaeology. Join us next episode as we continue our series on archaeology and the Bible, looking at the top 10 discoveries. And next, we're going to investigate the flood accounts. So you're going to want to join us. Until then, may the Lord richly bless you.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii That number there is 483-0586. Or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.